Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world, on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, happy to introduce our show to you today, December 10th, 2005, International Human Rights Day. Today, in our first hour, Tom Jackson interviews Mark Herold, Professor of Economics and Women's Studies at the University of New Hampshire, on his research on Afghan civilian casualties. We'll also hear Steve Diamond's commentary on the U.S. attack on Fallujah, Iraq, as well as music. Our second hour will feature people's history, music, and more, and we'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Connecticut. First, we go to Steve Diamond for some news.
This is Steve Diamond with some news from the past week. Today, on International Human Rights Day, we start with two stories about people speaking with words and actions for peace and rights for all. First, a local story from the Portsmouth Herald on December 8th. War protester arrested in Concord. Guy Chichester leads a life of peace and activism, and he was at it again when he was arrested on Tuesday afternoon in Concord. The Rye resident was one of eight peace activists from New Hampshire and Maine who campaigned at Senator Judd Gregg's office in Concord for a public meeting with the Republican senator on the war in Iraq. Chichester said, "Change doesn't come from the top. It never comes from the top." The group arrived at the office at mid-afternoon and delivered a letter calling for Gregg to hold a public meeting. It also delivered a petition with an additional 250 names supporting the issue. Chichester, 70, and others were told the senator, quote, "is very hard to get," by officials in the Concord office, but their papers were faxed to the senator's office in Washington, D.C. For the next several hours, Chichester said, while they waited for a response and checked in with the office manager, members of the group took turns reading the names of men and women in the U.S. Armed Forces who had been killed since last June. The group also read names of Iraqis who had been killed. "There have been previous attempts at Gregg's office to request a public meeting," Chichester said. The senator refused an earlier request, but has subsequently totally ignored the rest. And from the Associated Press, Nobel laureate Pinter assails Bush and Blair. Nobel literature laureate Harold Pinter slammed President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair in his prize acceptance speech, saying the two leaders should be prosecuted for the invasion of Iraq. In a pre-recorded lecture presented at the Swedish Academy in Stockholm on Wednesday, December 7th, the British playwright said Bush and Blair should be arraigned before the International Criminal Court. He said, "The invasion of Iraq was a bandit act, an act of blatant state terrorism, demonstrating absolute contempt for the concept of international law." Pinter, who has been treated for cancer in recent years, was supposed to have delivered the traditional Nobel lecture in person, but was forced to cancel his trip to Sweden because of poor health. In his lecture, Pinter launched a ferocious tirade against Bush and Blair, saying they were responsible for tens of thousands of deaths in the Iraq War. "How many people do you have to kill before you qualify to be described as a mass murderer and a war criminal?" he asked in a hoarse voice. "We have brought torture, cluster bombs, depleted uranium, innumerable acts of random murder, misery, degradation, and death to the Iraqi people, and call it bringing freedom and democracy to the Middle East," Pinter said. The Nobel Committee has not shied from rewarding writers who make a stand against authority. Notably, it rewarded the literature prize to Soviet dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn in 1970. Pinter accused the United States of supporting, quote, "every right-wing military dictatorship in the world after World War II, from Chile to the Philippines." "The crimes of the United States have been systematic, constant, vicious, remorseless, but very few people have actually talked about them," he said. He said both Bush and Blair deserve to be arraigned by The Hague, Netherlands-based International Criminal Court. "The U.S. has not ratified the court, but Britain has," Pinter noted, urging court officials to look for Blair at his home. "We can let the court have his address if they're interested. It is number 10 Downing Street, London," he said. The International Criminal Court is extremely unlikely to prosecute Blair because it is a court of last resort that will only intervene if national authorities are unwilling or unable to prosecute war criminals themselves. For the full text of Pinter's Nobel lecture, go to nobelprize.org. And from the Christian Science Monitor, an EU report criticizes Israeli expansion into the annexed part of the capital. Shoehorned into the slopes of Sheikh Jarrah, an Arab neighborhood in East Jerusalem, is the newer Jewish enclave Shimon HaTzadik, or Simon the Righteous. The 40 Israeli residents, guarded by a privately hired gunman, may soon have more compatriots just around the bend if the Shepherd's Hotel, a forlorn century-old building, is demolished and replaced with 90 housing units, as planned. The reason the newcomers came is the same reason the longtime residents would like to see them leave. The more Jews who settle in East Jerusalem Arab neighborhoods such as these, the less likely it is that Palestinians will be able to build the capital of their hoped-for state here. The Israelis, aided by ultranationalist groups that buy up Arab properties, and by the tacit support of the government, see themselves as pioneers. But Palestinians see them as settlers, and the European Union, soon to release a controversial report attacking, quote, the construction and expansion of illegal settlements by private entities and the Israeli government in and around East Jerusalem, appears to agree. The report, leaked to the press, sharply criticizes the growth of Israeli enclaves in East Jerusalem neighborhoods that surround the Old City, as well as Israeli plans to build up the E1 area, a tract of land between Jerusalem and the East Jerusalem settlement. Such Israeli expansion, critics argue, will cut off Palestinian areas in the West Bank from each other and from East Jerusalem, where Palestinians hope to build their capital. Several interlinked Israeli policies are reducing the possibility of reaching a final status agreement on Jerusalem, and demonstrate a clear Israeli intention to turn the annexation of East Jerusalem into a concrete fact, the draft EU report states, citing the ongoing construction of a security barrier which runs over the Green Line, Israel's pre-1967 boundary, into the West Bank. In a separate report issued Thursday, prominent Israeli human rights group B'Tselem presented what the group said was evidence that the wall's route was making way for settlement expansion in the territories, rather than focusing exclusively on security. That conclusion seemed to be supported by a key member of Ariel Sharon's government, Justice Minister Tzipi Livni, whose spokesman said Thursday that the borders of a future Palestinian state would be similar to the line drawn by the security barrier. Israeli government officials are quick to point out that East Jerusalem, formerly annexed by Israel in 1980, is by Israeli law part of the nation's capital. But that annexation was not recognized by most of the international community, the U.S. included. During her trip to Israel last month, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the Bush administration had, quote, been very clear that there should be no activities that prejudge a final status agreement. The Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, a group of peace activists, argues that the current growth in East Jerusalem does just that. A viable Palestinian state has to include East Jerusalem, says Jeff Halper, an anthropologist and ICHD's coordinator. Up to 40% of the Palestinian economy is dependent on it. If you cut Jerusalem out, and that's what plans like E1 are doing, you're cutting the economic heart out of any Palestinian state. And from the New York Times on December 9th, Al-Qaeda Iraq link U.S. cited is tied to coercion claim. The Bush administration based a crucial pre-war assertion about ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda on detailed statements made by a prisoner while in Egyptian custody, who later said he had been fabricating them to escape harsh treatment, according to current and former government officials. The officials said the captive, Ibn al-Shaykh al-Libi, provided his most specific and elaborate accounts about ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda only after he was secretly handed over to Egypt by the United States in January 2002 in a process known as rendition. The new disclosure provides the first public evidence that bad intelligence on Iraq may have resulted partly from the administration's heavy reliance on third countries to carry out interrogations of Al-Qaeda members and others detained as part of American counterterrorism efforts. The Bush administration used Mr. Libby's accounts as the basis for its pre-war claims, now discredited, that ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda included training in explosives and chemical weapons. The fact that Mr. Libby recanted after the American invasion of Iraq and that intelligence based on his remarks was withdrawn by the CIA in March 2004 has been public for more than a year. But American officials had not previously acknowledged either that Mr. Libby made the false statements in foreign custody or that Mr. Libby contended that his statements had been coerced. And finally, from the Associated Press on December 8th, Appeals Court to hear Mumia Abu-Jamal case. A federal appeals court has agreed to hear an appeal from death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal, the former Black Panther convicted in the 1981 murder of a white Philadelphia police officer. In the most significant ruling in the case in 4 years, the Third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said it would consider three of Abu-Jamal's claims. Abu-Jamal, 51, a one-time radio reporter, was convicted in 1982 of shooting Daniel Faulkner, 25, after the officer pulled over Abu Jamal's brother in 1981. Prosecutor Hugh Burns called the decision a blow to Abu Jamal's defense because the court dismissed dozens of other claims from the inmate. Abu Jamal's writings and taped speeches on the justice system have made him a cause célèbre among Hollywood activists, foreign politicians, and some death penalty opponents who believe he is the victim of a racist justice system. In 2001, a federal court overturned Abu Jamal's death sentence but upheld his conviction. Both sides have appealed that ruling, and Abu Jamal remains on death row. The appeals court said Tuesday it will consider Abu Jamal's claim that prosecutors illegally removed blacks from the jury pool, that a prosecutor gave an improper summation to the jury, and that the judge in a previous appeal was biased. That's all the news we have for now. Next, let's hear some of the words the criminal injustice system wants to silence from Amia, recorded on December 2nd.
All the news? Question mark. In the wake of this wretched war, we have more than enough reason to look with jaundiced eye at the American major media. The adjectives that have been used to describe their performance in the face of fake evidence, scare tactics, and global state terrorism against the poor and the weak, and their abject servitude to the centers of political and economic power have been terms like supine, servile, and genuflective. The corporate media became an instrument through which the White House worked its way upon the public, threatening dissidents, locking up innocents, threatening other countries, all in pursuance of madness. The media, afraid of alienating its audiences and, more importantly, of upsetting government officials, opened its pages, its airwaves, and its microphones, serving only as amplifiers for the state. Few mainstream papers have the heft and influence of the New York Times, yet even there, their star reporter became little more than a stenographer for the neocons at the highest levels of power. They served not the interests of their readers, nor their children, but of power. Remember the spectacle of a vampirish Vice President Dick Cheney citing the Times, of all sources, in support of his claims of WMDs? Now, trapped by the very real threat of civil war, U.S. politicians find themselves pinned to the wall like monarch butterflies forced to support the insupportable. Now comes word of secret prisons in the lands of the former Soviet Union, run by the CIA, where God knows what is being done to people in the name of a nebulous war on terror. Does anyone really believe that American forces aren't engaged in torture? The new U.S.-appointed regime in Iraq has learned well the lessons of its American paymasters. In the shadow of Abu Ghraib, dozens of Sunnis are tortured and caged in secret prisons. What, pray tell, are the Americans to say? Don't do as we do? We've virtually forgotten the case of Chinese-American Muslim chaplain James Yee. New Jersey-born, a West Point graduate, it was during his former tour in Saudi Arabia that he learned about Islam, where he was intrigued by the cultural diversity. For complaining about the treatment that he saw and heard at Guantanamo Bay Naval Station, he found himself labeled and soon treated as an enemy combatant charged with espionage and called a known terrorist sympathizer. He was put into the three-piece suit, shackled hands, feet, and belly. He was thrown into solitary confinement. That's according to his new book, For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. He was in solitary for 76 days before charges were dropped. All of this comes back to the role of the press. It either serves the interests of freedom or it serves the interests of empire. It can't serve both. It is doing the reporting now that should have been done before the outbreak of war. Most reporters knew that there was absolutely no link between 9/11 and Iraq. Most reporters knew, if they'd done their research, that there was absolutely no connection between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. Yet through fear or the ingrained instinct to serve power, they allowed the Bush regime to let slip the dogs of war. Unless I miss my guess, it'll be plenty years before we really see the end of this adventure. That's because it will be many years before things will even begin to quiet down in Iraq. Perhaps 100,000 Iraqis have been killed, many by the U.S. Army and Air Force. Over 2,000 Americans have died. Billions of dollars have been wasted or ripped off by corrupt Iraqi politicians or American corporations. and Americans have done little more than stoke the fires of anti-American hatred throughout the region. Recently, the Muslim Brotherhood, a staunch opponent of the Mubarak regime in Egypt, won over 100 times, really over 500 times their previous seats in parliament. Islamist parties are stronger than ever in the Muslim world, largely as a direct reaction to the U.S. invasion in Iraq. The media could have prevented much of this if only it had done its job. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal, author of We Want Freedom, A Life in the Black Panther Party.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
That was a recent commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal. I think he meant a 500% increase in representatives for the Muslim Brotherhood. Next, we have our own Tom Jackson interviewing UNH professor Mark Harold.
For Making Waves, I'm Tom Jackson. 4 years ago, Mark Harold was compiling a list of civilian casualties in Afghanistan that occurred because of the U.S. bombing in response to 9/11. I talked with Mark today about the response that he got 4 years ago to his civilian casualty count, as well as the way things are in Afghanistan today, and some of his current work, which includes an advisory position with Iraq Body Count.
Mark, I wanted to talk with you about, first of all, what made you decide to start trying to get a count of civilian casualties in Afghanistan in 2001?
I was contacted by some old friends of mine in the west coast of California in mid-October 2001, about a week, 10 days after the bombing started. The purpose was to contribute a chapter to a book which was planned and which ultimately came out in February 2002 called September 11th and the U.S. War, Beyond the Curtain of Smoke. And the chapter was on the human costs of war. They decided that I was an appropriate person to write that, the reason being that in the past I've put together lots of large-scale databases from many different sources, and so I was in some ways, from their perspective, the ideal person to do that. It took me a good 10 days to accept. I wasn't sure I was going to do that, and ultimately they persuaded me to do it, and so I launched into that in the end of October. And it's an ongoing project. It's continuing now. Just last weekend, there was another attack, aerial attack, on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, where civilians died as a result of a Hellfire missile being fired from a CIA-operated drone.
Well, some people might be surprised, you know, to hear that. I think there's sort of a general public perception that Afghanistan is history and there's not that much going on there. Can you give us some details in terms of this latest thing that you just, latest incident that you just mentioned? Are there particular people that you now have some information about who were killed, civilians that were killed in that attack?
Oh, yes. I have names of people, descriptions of the event, the incident, and so on. It's actually up in the database, the Afghan Victim Memorial Project, which can be accessed. It's a website database. Which chronicles casualties, giving names and circumstances, family relations, time of the attack, weapon of the attack, and so on and so forth. What's happening in about a half of Afghanistan, the southern and eastern and northeastern part of Afghanistan, is it's war. It's just continuing war. It's now being changed in a certain sense, that some of the tactics of the Iraqi imbroglio are now being used in Afghanistan. There's heavy use of improvised explosive devices, and there's increasing use now of suicide bombers, which is absolutely unheard of in Afghanistan, but it began about a year ago, and this seems to be escalating, and this is going out into areas way beyond the rest of South, the rest of East, and the rest of Northeast. So there really is there's an ongoing conflict in about half of Afghanistan. The northwestern part of Afghanistan is relatively peaceful. That's the area where the Uzbeks, Tajiks, live and have lived, and to some extent the Hazaras, another large group. But even there, there are bombings and attacks and so on. So the country is in continuing turmoil.
So have you seen any changes as a result of the elections that have gone on? Do you feel as though that's really changed much of anything in terms of the violence there?
No, absolutely not. And, you know, there's a lot of criticism. RAVA, the women's group, has published an article not long ago critical of the elections, giving enormous detail about why the election was in some ways a farce. This was, in many ways, I think, an election for publicity in the United States. How is it possible to really have an election when half the country is at war? And a similar kind of situation exists in Iraq. I mean, this is, you know, you can't have, most of the candidates were not able to get out of the public. And the way the election took place was the local leaders, you know, basically got their people together and to vote for them. And this is not really an open election. This is in some ways, a ratification of conquest.
Going back to the civilian count that you were, you know, that you started 4 years ago, or a little more than 4 years ago, that was met with a fair amount of controversy. But first, before you maybe give some details on what happened and some of the reaction that you got, you talk a little bit about how you went about and continue to go about keeping this database of civilians in Afghanistan who have been killed as a result of our ongoing battles there.
I look at as much information as possible which comes out of Afghanistan and surrounding areas, and sometimes areas which are quite far away. For example, Australia. Australia has a number of, or had, and to some extent still has, a number of journalists who have been in Afghanistan, been in the border areas, and so on and so forth, and report. So I looked at all the wire services. I looked at all the newspapers published in Pakistan, Iran, surrounding areas, India, European, and so on. So the count was put together on the basis of information coming out of Afghanistan and surrounding areas. It was not only wire services. It included occasionally reports from the International Red Cross, from UN agencies, non-governmental organizations, individual reporters who happened to be in Afghanistan. There were a couple Americans, independents, not associated with any large news service, who actually wrote up stories of things which they had seen. So it's a collection of information from a wide, wide, wide disparity of different sources, and I'll add in different languages too. You know, and that's really the kind of thing which, for about 30 years, I've been doing, is putting together databases on particular items in that fashion.
Tell us about some of the response that, you know, once your information started getting out there in the media. I know that there was some backlash. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, it's interesting. There was backlash. There was excitement. There was interest. There was ignoring. Basically, the American corporate media simply ignored it until early February of 2002, when one of the more independent reporters of the for working for the New York Times, I ran a front page story and actually mentioned the database. This was Barry Birak. But in Europe, it was once the Guardian ran a very important front page article on, I believe it was December 20th, 2001. And at that point, the information couldn't be ignored anymore. It was picked up everywhere in Europe. The major newspapers, from Le Monde to La Repubblica to Corriere della Sera to Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, and even Zurich, Switzerland, and English newspapers, Swedish newspapers, etc. So in Europe, there was interest, there was receptivity. I actually had a number of interviews with interviews with television folks who actually came over to this country from. from Greece, from Sweden, from Germany, and I can't remember. I think there was another one. So there was interest, receptivity. Let's get this information out. Europe outside of the United States. Same thing for Asia, India, Australia, Malaysia. No problems. The problems were here. In the United States, and in a way that's not surprising. I mean, the message was very clearly given out in early October by the Pentagon. It was picked up and amplified by leaders of major media here, and that is civilian casualties were not to be spoken about, and we should certainly not have any pictures and photos of the destruction caused by the bombing. By the way, the website, which I mentioned earlier, has a collection of some 400 to 500 photos of the effects of the bombing and also what's been happening in Afghanistan since. So it's a really quite a unique collection of photos which illustrate, you know, the effects of bombing and the so-called, reconstruction, which is really not reconstruction. It's more, I think, the creation of a Western facsimile in Afghanistan, and it's quite different. Kabul is not Afghanistan. Afghanistan is out in the countryside, and 80% of the people in Afghanistan live in rural areas. The progressive press and the radio stations, the progressive media, tremendous interest. I would have on an average day, end of 2001, up to probably 3 months into 2002, I would have somewhere between 10 and 15 interviews daily. So there was enormous interest. I received thousands and probably tens of thousands of emails over the course of 2 years. So I basically couldn't keep up. In many instances, I mean, I'm a single person here. I also have a job. I do teach classes, and I just couldn't keep up. So I answered the ones I could, and the rest didn't. I didn't. But there was an enormous interest in the community, alternative media, church groups, human rights organizations, etc. The project also evolved into a critique of the mainstream media, because it, as I was doing this over the course of years, I mean, it just became so obvious that the U.S. corporate mainstream media was simply, to some extent, basically in bed with the Pentagon, and didn't want to report on the downside, if you want, of the bombing and the occupation. And so, you know, one of the side projects I've done is really get into constructing a critique of the mainstream corporate media and the reporting on war nowadays. And I think this is very important, because one of the things which is apparently going to happen in Iraq, as the United States, and I believe they will, withdraw troops. I don't think they'll certainly withdraw all, but maybe down to 50,000. And in some ways, Iraqize the conflict, just like Vietnamization. And they're going to, they've said very clearly that they're going to step up the aerial bombing. They're going to do a lot more of this. And so the prospects of lots of civilian casualties as a result of renewed and probably increased aerial bombing is there for all to see. And I think that the work I've been doing in terms of the casualties of modern bombing campaigns is therefore, you know, going to become yet more important. One of the things which is gratifying for me is that some people out there in the world, as in England and in the United States, have used the civilian casualty count to do some very creative political art as a way of getting out into communities. And I have one in particular in mind, which I think is a really wonderful project. And this was put together in 2005 by a fellow living south of Tucson, Arizona. And he put together something called the American Afghanistan and Iraq Children's Memorial. And it's a very interesting, beautiful, creative way of getting people to think about the civilian casualties of war. So he has this show, which he travels around showing. It was up at the University of Arizona recently. You know, very, very interesting and very poignant and very powerful. It's constructed as a labyrinth, and you enter this, and you have these tombstones in all kinds of interesting shapes, and each tombstone has the name of somebody, including the, I believe it was three children who died in the attacks at the World Trade Center. And then, you know, there are a lot of Afghans, of course, children, and there are a lot of Iraqi. It's something you walk through most people walk through in silence and look at and emerge really shaken. And his plan, he bought a large bus, and he's going to be touring around the country showing this in various different places. There are people in England who have done other things in terms of using this information for political art. And I'm really happy because that was kind of the original intent. I mean, the original intent was I was putting together information which could be used, I was hoping, and it's been used in many, many different ways. And I'm particularly gratified to see that, you know, people who have much more artistic inclinations and experiences than I do, you know, have picked this up and done some very interesting things with it. So that's, you know, that's something very gratifying.
You started to touch on Afghanistan today, and of course you're continuing to keep an eye on what's going on there. And as I was mentioning before, there's a tendency, especially in mainstream media, which so many people still rely on for their information, to have sort of forgotten about Afghanistan and assume that everything's fine. And yet, anyone who takes a good close look sees that that's not quite accurate. Can you talk about what you're seeing in Afghanistan today in terms of general living conditions for people, and as you pointed out before, the difference between what's going on in Kabul and what's going on in the rest of Afghanistan?
Well, I think the differences are beautifully illustrated by two wire service reports which came out very close to each other, early December of this year. Incidentally, they are not put out by the Associated Press, but they're put out by Reuters and the Agence France-Presse. I think the Associated Press, a mainstream U.S. organization, which has been, I think, particularly bad in its reporting of Afghanistan, with a couple notable exceptions. Kathy Gannon was their correspondent in Afghanistan late 2001, 2002. Her reports are terrific. And what I'm saying here has in fact been echoed by Kathy Gannon very recently in a piece she wrote, which is accessible on the internet. So the two articles, the first one, this is Agence France-Presse, Afghan prosperity, a dream for most, frustration grows, and it's the account of some people who returned to Afghanistan in early 2002 and now regret having returned and are trying to get back to Iran, where as a refugee their life was much better than what they found in Afghanistan. It's a very detailed report available on Reuters. Then the other report is from Agence France-Presse, and it's about, I think the title of the article is really quite interesting, and it is Miniskirts Dating in Afghan's Herat After Warlord Leaves. Herat also opened up a brand new 5-star luxury hotel this past weekend, where no doubt those young Afghan women, I doubt there'll be very many, but they will be able to go in their miniskirts. And, you know, this is what I meant earlier. This is just one illustration of what I meant earlier in terms of creating a Western facsimile in some of the urban areas, which are protected not by peacekeepers. Let's be very clear about that. Language matters here. These are not peacekeepers. These are occupation forces. And if I could just say something else about language, because language matters. It is not a coalition. in Afghanistan. It is a U.S. occupying force with some assistance. The command is firmly in the hands of the United States. They are not peacekeepers. They are occupation forces. They are not terrorists who are fighting, but they are resistance fighters, just like in Algeria during the Algerian National Liberation War, which I happen to know quite a bit about. I lived in France at that time. They were resistance fighters, and they did blow up cafes, and they did things of this sort, but back then they were not really called terrorists. They were called resistance fighters. And I think that's important to point out. And similarly, with this whole business of reconstruction, it is reconstruction along the lines of sort of a Western model, I would say a decrepit version of what you find in Pakistan.
It's interesting, having been to Afghanistan and mostly in Kabul a year and a half ago myself, I have even found people at screenings of videos that I took while I was in Afghanistan. I had one person out in Minnesota when I was there showing the video that looks at Afghanistan. And she very sort of matter-of-factly, not confrontationally at all, but matter-of-factly afterwards said, "Oh, my son's in the military, and he was in Afghanistan, and things have improved a lot since this was back in the spring of 2005. Things have improved a lot." He was talking about downtown Kabul and these brand new, huge skyscrapers that have been built and all this kind of stuff. I hadn't heard anything about any great, big, you know, grand skyscrapers or anything being built in Kabul. Do you know anything about what, you know?
That is correct. That person was absolutely correct. There's a very large new, I think it's 12-story high, steel and glass and aluminum and various other things, mall, which is now opened. It looks like New York City, or it looks like downtown Los Angeles. There are fountains. It's as luxurious as possible. Multi-story, as I said, and you know that's there. It's in the equivalent of, you know, in Baghdad, the green zone, and that is a heavily protected area, very close naturally to the U.S. embassy and the like. So there certainly is that in Kabul, and the area is called the Roshan Towers. And it, as I said before, it really does look like, you know, downtown New York, Manhattan, or Los Angeles. And, you know, apparently now we see a somewhat similar kind of thing happening in Herat. I don't think this is going to happen in Khost and Jalalabad and in Kandahar, which are areas where the fighting still continues. So, in some ways, what this soldier saw was an aspect of Kabul. That is correct. And there are clubs. There's apparently one which opened not long ago, which has a swimming pool in the shape of a flamingo or something of that sort. And this is available at a nightly rate in the new hotel which opened up put together by the Aga Khan Foundation in Kabul not long ago. One night ranges from $200 to $500 a night, when you know the average income of the average person in Kabul is about $30 a month. This is an incredibly polarized society, polarized by class, and it's deepening. I mean, that polarization is deepening, and I think that's reflected in, you know, the things I mentioned earlier, that, you know, some people are simply packing up and leaving. Life was better in as a refugee in Iran.
Well, I want to get back to Afghanistan in just a second, but I also want to ask you about your involvement with the Iraq body count, which is, I'm amazed all the time at how many different web pages nowadays have the Iraq body count. The little, you know, square on their page, and there's the sort of spread of possible numbers or estimated numbers or something like that. And you, I understand, have some sort of advisory role in terms of starting it. And is that an ongoing thing?
Well, it's an interesting story. In early 2003, a couple months before the American invasion of and occupation subsequently of Iraq took place, I was having conversations with a couple people in England, and bilaterally, they did not know each other, And each of them asked me the same question, and that was, oh, Mark, you know, the bombing is going to start in Iraq soon, and are you going to do the same thing for Iraq? And I told them that it was just absolutely inconceivable. I couldn't do that. I was working 12 hours a day on this Afghan thing, and as I said before, I do have a job, and, you know, normal people do have to sleep a bit. So I kind of jokingly said to one of them when he brought the question up again, well, why don't you do it? And he said, oh, you know, I guess I could, but, you know, you're going to have to tell me, you know, how to do this. I mean, how do you do this? And I said, okay, I'll do that. And that then ensued a long, long conversation over many, many days, weeks. And I contacted the other person and said, John Slapota, who's one of the founding researchers and members of Iraq Body Count. John, you know, another fellow over here wants to do a count of when the bombing starts, of what's going on in Iraq. Do you want to be part of that? And he said, sure, that sounds great. I think we should do this. And so I set the two of them up. And that really was the beginning of the Iraq Body Count project. It began with two people, and they then expanded the core group to about 15, which is wonderful. I mean, if I had had 14 other people, I mean, it would have been, you know, I could have done so much more and better work than I was able to do. So they were basically ready in early March of 2003, and they got right into doing this the minute the bombing started, and, you know, subsequently the occupation, the fighting, and the resistance, and the civil war to some extent. And so I served as sort of the, in some ways, the instigator, if you want, of Iraq Body Count. And then subsequently, I've invariably, probably about once a month or so, I have conversations with either Hamid Dardagan or John Slapota, the two principal researchers, about technical matters. And, you know, when things come up and they have questions, or, you know, there's some controversy, how to respond to something, we talk about that. So it's an ongoing relationship, and I've learned a lot from them because I think they have really improved the method of doing this, and I think they've just had a tremendous impact. It's wonderful to see.
Going back to Afghanistan, I understand you've got three books out of the incredible amount of research that you've done on an ongoing basis for over 4 years now. You've got a few different books either in the works, or is one of them published already, or can you tell us about that?
One of them is waiting to be published, and it's been edited, everything. The producer, a wonderful press, doesn't have the upfront money to run the publishing run, and is $5,000 short before he or they can, you know, start doing this. Common Courage Press. It's the book which has been up on the internet for a long time. The cover of the book, it's a book called Blown Away, the Myth and Reality of Precision Bombing in Afghanistan, and it's a chronicle and analysis of the bombing campaign. The bottom line being that precision bombing is anything but precise. So this is really an account of the bombing campaign and the raids thereafter, the ground raids, and it's a history in some sense of the Afghan imbroglio during the first 2 to 3 years. The second book, which I began doing in 2002, is really a book on so-called development, if you want, of Afghanistan. And it's called Modernizing Afghanistan, How 50 Years of Interventions Impoverished a Once Frugal Society. This is an examination of Afghanistan during the 20th century and how a frugal society came to be one in which you have a lot of modern poverty. And that one is in the works. And the third one in the works is something called Afghan Bodies Don't Lie, Faces of Collateral Damage. And this is a compilation of what it felt like to be bombed, told by people, survivors. And it's based upon the website, which I've mentioned earlier, Afghan Victim Memorial. And it's a truly devastating account, and I think should put to rest, I hope, once and for all, this idea that the U.S. Air Force and Navy and so on don't cause a lot of civilian casualties.
So for people who want to keep up with your work, we'll be sure to mention the website and the address. I guess I'm wondering, with all of the information about what has gone on in Afghanistan since we began bombing and the current conditions there, do you see signs of hope for the future in Afghanistan, or do you see more of the same sort of poverty and oppression and so on?
Unfortunately, I do not see signs of hope. I see endless war. I see two Afghanistans, the Afghanistan of downtown Kabul, which your soldier, acquaintance there, the person who spoke about a soldier, mentioned and described. I suspect there'll be a bit more of that in urban areas in Afghanistan, maybe some rural areas. And then you'll have the vast expanses of central Afghanistan, northern Afghanistan, northeastern Afghanistan, eastern Afghanistan, southern Afghanistan, southwestern Afghanistan, where it's just going to be a continuation of what has been. Throw in one added dimension, and that is that Afghanistan is now the world's greatest supplier of opium. And this introduces another dimension into, you know, what is happening in rural Afghanistan as it affects average people's lives. So I'm not optimistic as to what's going to happen, and I wish I could be more optimistic, but I'm not.
Do you have suggestions for what concerned listeners could do to try to help the situation in any way?
Well, I think the most important thing is to, you know, to educate oneself, to read, to talk about this in communities, and forums and so on, so that ultimately this percolates up through, our society, so that pressure is put to change course, that the current program of an occupying army with an absolutely absurd idea of state building, namely to create a highly centralized form of governance in Afghanistan, which for the last 300 years has not had anything of that sort. It is impossible to have a strong central government in Afghanistan. The only way that that's going to be possible is by having an absolutely ruthless military and police dictatorship. This is a country which has been very decentralized for a long, long time, and the resistance to any kind of central rule is just going to be ferocious. Afghanistan is a country of villages, it's a country of families, it's a country of clans. And to somehow impose a Western conception of democracy with a strong centralized authority based in Kabul, backed up by an occupation army or a trained police and national army, it's just not going to work. I think that the emphasis has to change and, you know, go back to constructing in some way a very decentralized political structure in Afghanistan. And let me just throw this in because I feel so strongly about it, and get away from constructing a Western facsimile. It is scandalous that within the Ministry of Women's Affairs in Afghanistan, you have a Western beauty school, which is touted on the internet by some of the quote-unquote feminist non-governmental organizations who all of a sudden discovered Afghan women after 9/11, which I think speaks a lot about the interests of these organizations, that before that, nobody cared about Afghan women. But all of a sudden, we have all these wonderful feminists, including Mrs. Blair and Mrs. Bush, who descend upon Afghanistan to defend Afghan women. And we have, you know, all these folks in this country who now are so excited about seeing beauty return to Afghan women because they can have lipstick and manicures and facials and so on and so forth.
Lots of excitement from Revlon and...
In fact, Revlon and a couple of the other countries financed the beauty school and the Ministry of Women's Affairs in downtown Kabul, probably right next to the mall.
Mark Harrell, thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's been my pleasure. This is great. And Tom, I hope you get your information out, because you have firsthand experience in this. I'm recounting what I can get from here and from speaking with people, and also from my interactions with Rava in Afghanistan. And I think firsthand experience being there is something absolutely critical.
That was Tom Jackson interviewing Mark Harold. Mark Harold is a professor of economics and women's studies at the University of New Hampshire. His research on Afghan civilian casualties, including the Afghan Victims Memorial Project, can be accessed at pubpages.unh.edu/MWHEROLD. That's pubpages.unh.edu/MWHEROLD. H-E-R-O-L-D. Was The Nuns with Do You Want Me on My Knees. Next, we have a commentary I wrote for nhindymedia.org. The column is called Between Iraq and a Hard Place, and this article is Fallujah, the Hidden Massacre. The world knows what we did there, but most Americans don't. When Saddam Hussein allegedly used the horrific weapon white phosphorus against the Kurds, the U.S. military called it a chemical weapon. When allegations came out that it was used in the assault on Fallujah, the news parroted the State Department's claim that it was used only for illumination. And when rising public outrage brought more pressure on U.S. officials, they finally admitted that white phosphorus was used as a weapon, but only against enemy combatants. For a while, so much media scrutiny was on the issue that the State Department saw fit to revise its disinformation, admitting that their previous statements were false. As was widely reported before the assault on Fallujah, 50,000 civilians remained in the city. Because the U.S. military barred unembedded journalists from the area, it's hard to know what really happened there. But we do know, from soldiers' accounts, that enormous amounts of explosives were used, leveling thousands of buildings. Here is a satellite image of the city from before the assault. If you can face the gore and destruction, watch this Italian documentary for yourself and see the satellite photos from after the assault, where much of the city has been leveled from high explosives and massive incendiary bombardment. This documentary includes some disputable assertions. The narrator is not a forensics expert, and the soldier interviewed is not an authority on the chemical properties of white phosphorus. But due to the Bush administration's extraordinary suppression of independent reporting, including an apparent policy of shooting unembedded journalists, bombing Al Jazeera in Baghdad, and plans to bomb their offices in Qatar, it remains our best means of understanding this pivotal moment in the war. The key assertions made in the documentary are illustrated with raw footage and first-hand testimony by U.S. soldiers who were there. U.S. generals knew that 50,000 civilians remained in Fallujah, yet they ordered their soldiers to shoot on sight and authorized the illegal use of heavy weapons, causing massive destruction. There can be no doubt that many innocent civilians were killed, despite the claims arrogant politicians make about surgical precision. Such tactics probably guarantee that all the local residents will be hostile to the occupation after they used, but not before. Largely hostile residential areas cannot be secured without heavy casualties or massive force. Massive force kills the innocent. The world sees this brutality, can't help but do the long division to determine how many Iraqi lives are worth one American soldier, and rallies against the U.S. That is why reporting is suppressed, but it never works forever. Global opinion now views the U.S. with disgust and hostility. The war is already a complete strategic and moral failure. We must withdraw now and free Iraq from foreign occupation, which is the main cause of death and destruction for the Iraqi people. After all, who is the U.S. military supposedly there to help? I'm planning on organizing a local showing of the RAI documentary around the second week of January in the Dover area. I believe most people will find it quite fair and balanced, but be warned that it is a graphic, uncensored view of the reality of war. If you would like to attend or help organize this event, let me know. Once again, you can find this column at nhindymedia.org at the right bar, including numerous supporting links to the State Department website, the RAI documentary, and other sources. There is also a before and after satellite image of Eastern Fallujah.
Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living with AIDS? Would you harbor a Tubman, a fugitive or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian, Korean or Czech, a lesbian or a gay? Would you harbor a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living with AIDS? Would you harbor a Tubman, a fugitive or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian, Korean or Czech, a lesbian or a gay? Would you thank you.
That was Would You Harbor Me by Sweet Honey in the Rock.